That's Lester Bowie with Brass Fantasy, and that was the selection Nessun Dorma from Giacomo Puccini's Turandot. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Tuesday, April the 23rd, and we get back on track with our media literacy series, focusing today on the media's self-assigned role in a perceived national crisis. And of course, we've been talking about the perceived national crisis occurring on April the 15th with two bombs being detonated at the Boston Marathon, causing incredible carnage, killing three and wounding more than, or they're now upping the ante, saying it's now more than 180 and closer to 200 spectators and runners. Well, before I get to that point, let me just do a couple of relevant updates. Terror suspect Zohar Tsarnaev, yesterday was charged with two federal counts of using a weapon of mass destruction to kill, injure, and cause widespread damage at the Boston Marathon on the 15th. Other federal charges may be brought against him later as evidence is developed, but if he is found guilty at trial on these charges alone, he faces the death penalty or life in prison without parole. Also, the federal charges do not preclude other charges the state may consider against him. Bail hearing is held this morning in Toronto for two men charged with an alleged Al-Qaeda-inspired plan to derail a passenger train in the Toronto area, which they said could have led to innocent people being killed or injured. The two accused, Shihab Azaghir, a Tunisian living in Montreal, and Raid Jasser, a Palestinian who lived in the United Arab Emirates before moving to Toronto, were charged with conspiring to carry out an attack and commit murder at the direction of or in association with a terrorist group. Jasser was given a new court date for May 23rd and did not enter a plea, and the court granted a request by his lawyer for a publication ban on future evidence and testimony. Zakayer is scheduled to appear in court later today. Well, as we get back to the subject now, I want you to keep in mind that we've discussed that the gatekeepers of news, the people who control what we read and see and hear in the way of information, are themselves byproducts of elitist institutions for the most part, and that are compatible with the power structure. They may insist that they differ in political ideology, but that is simply a technicality when it comes to matters of so-called national importance. And we're talking now how the major media function in a national crisis. In times of a national crisis or perceived national crisis, the media's job primarily is to protect the interests of the state. Now, they can say what they want. I'm giving you my analysis, and, you know, whoever wants to disagree can do so. But that's the major media's primary objective, and their immediate task is to protect the interests of the state. They automatically accept this role as conduits of information, of state-provided information, state-sanctioned information. And they automatically edit themselves so as not to go against the grain or the interests of the state in conveying this type of information to the public. They shore up the national fervor, the identity, the national identity, the American way of life. All these cliche things are very meaningful in the immediate aftermath of what people see as a a national crisis occurring. And at the same time, they identify the enemy that is threatening the American way of life. So first they shore up the American way of life or the national identity, and at the same time they are very clear in communicating who and what is threatening this national identity. Now, we are talking here in a bit, we're talking idealistically, because we know that we are a race-based society, and we know in the absence of anything that would cause us to come together, we actually are very much apart. That's our natural state of affairs. So that in a sense, the work of the media is to create an artificial coming together. We are one. We are a unit. We are a nation, which of course flies in the face of facts. But in times of a national crisis, these things are thrown out the window. They are no longer important. Why? Because the primary agent of this information is the fear factor. And in the face of fear, we would tend to do things that we are normally not disposed to doing. In the face of fear, if that is created well enough, all these things would suddenly become unimportant, but we will see that they maintain a certain caste division as we go along. I'll show that to you. In the immediate aftermath, and while these things are going on, in order to maintain the notion of a unified nation, they create the us versus them kind of dichotomy. We are all united on this side because we have to fight them, and they are trying to do harm to us. So in this atmosphere, there's very little tolerance for views that go outside that arena or that are against the grain. There's no wiggle room here. The media all agree. There's no middle room. There's no wiggle room. It's black or white. It's up or down. It's right or wrong. It's friend or enemy. It's very stark. There's no leeway, no elastic, and there's no tolerance really for, hey, you know, let's rethink this. No, it's already thought of, and this is the formula in the immediate aftermath. The truth is as the state sees it. The truth is as the state says it is. Objectivity has no place in this atmosphere. There's no room for disagreement. And much of what we read and see and hear involves government as the source. So that says that in the immediate situation, the media themselves dispense with the notion of independent journalism. Why? Because in the immediate situation, they depend on the government as a source of information. And they develop this relationship where the government feeds them stuff, they broadcast it or they print it. And that is the nature of the relationship in the period when the national crisis is first perceived. They don't have any time independently to develop sources or to do independent reporting and investigation. They are under the gun because now they have, in a way, accelerated their production because now they have to meet deadlines, strict deadlines, and the government and their sources within government are fast and furious with the feeds, and they carry them. And every now and then, you know, they pretend that they use the word alleged a lot, which covers the tracks, which gives them some degree of credibility, the alleged so-and-so. But primarily, their sources of information are the government. The very people they should be questioning are the people that they partner with in serving up this steady diet of nationalistic fervor. In a perceived national crisis, they therefore demonstrate their allegiance first to the state, not to the reader, not to the listener, not to the viewer, but to the state. And the state, in turn, is looking for reciprocity. They want to know that the media outlets are doing their jobs, presenting the problem to America the way we see it, or the way we want them to see it. And if the media people play along, well, you know, they will continue to provide them information beyond the immediate moment, and they'll have a nice reciprocal relationship going. If they don't, and the media organizations understand this, if they don't play ball, the government cuts access, it cuts and limits their the information that comes to them, and sometimes the government punishes them by simply not feeding them any material at all. So there is this symbiotic relationship that goes on. So in the immediate situation of a perceived national crisis, as a consumer of information, you have to be especially sensitive to the idea that much of what you are going to be reading, although you will be presented certain facts, but you will see that it's the same facts. Every Joe Doakes has it, Mary Moakes has it, Peter Polk has it. The facts are generally the same. They will differ here and there, but nothing substantial, because the media are being spoon-fed at this stage, and they agree to do that. They agree to present the case of the state without any direct challenges whatsoever, because now the issue is they are now the propaganda outlet for the state apparatus. But then you will see a shift occurring. After a steady diet of that, you will begin to see a slight weaning off. And they will begin to examine themselves and say, well, wait a minute. There are other things we should be looking at. They'll now start to question themselves. You'll get questions from the inside. Editors will start discussing other angles that may be developed, other pieces of the story that need to be filled out, and entirely different approaches to the story other than what has been fed to them. So they also are looking, in other words, for ways to distinguish themselves from the pack. The sameness that used to be in their stories and everybody else's stories, very much the same. You could literally, at one stage, flip from one channel to another, and it's exactly the same story. Or you read one newspaper or the other, it's exactly the same story. Or you hear news reports on radio, it's exactly the same story. But there's a movement, and it's a kind of interesting development. This is part of the cycle where they begin to move a little bit away from this steady diet that is being fed to them. And for the sake, if nothing else than their own journalistic, quote, integrity, unquote, they begin to develop their own approaches. And the tone begins to change. And they begin to ask questions and to be they begin to examine the gaping holes in the official stories, and they begin to wonder whether the information that they've been spreading all along, how solid was it? How relevant was it? Is there something that they deliberately were not told? And now two important factors come into play. One is the professional reputation and acumen of the news professional within the established media. And then you have something else happening, and that is the media organization itself. Let me tackle the first one, the one where we see the professional reputation and acumen. People feel the need now to break away from the pack. They want to make a name for themselves. They see this as an opportunity for promotions, for moving up the ladder within the news organization, and they want to independently function. They want to basically flex their professional muscle. But the media organization also has an independent plan of its own, and it also shares that with the individual news professionals, because now they begin to discuss the matter of money. For the professional, it's about accomplishment in for the purpose of future returns, and for the media organization, it is now about increasing. Did this coverage that they provided, did it increase viewership? Did it increase circulation? Did it increase listenership? Did it enhance their ability to make the case to advertisers that they should be paid more because they have increased their circulations? Now, this is a really interesting thing. And you find that at this stage, money and personal motivation become now a big concern to the individual and to the organization he or she is working for. And don't underestimate it. This is huge. This is why you now begin to see, when you turn on the television, you begin to see some faces more prominently than others. As in CNN, you'll see Anderson Cooper, or you would see on Fox News, you would see one or two people dominating the bigger and more special parts of reports that are being offered. You begin to see columnists appearing more regularly as authorities. You begin to see people taking ownership and individualizing the editorial contributions. This is an effort to distinguish themselves. The media organizations will be depending on this and will be using this as part of the case that they can later make to advertisers that in the coverage of XYZ event, as in this case, they hold the exclusives on everything. They ran more exclusives. They tripled their circulation, or they quadrupled their viewership, or they ran more specials and so forth. These are things that enhance the media organization's ability to command higher advertising rates. You will find in this period more and more specials are being offered. They're doing more and more special reports, and this is not accidental. This is also to gain recognition in the industry because, you know, they want to win this prize and that prize and the other prize, and every prize they win, cha-ching, they can market that and as an enhanced aspect of the editorial product. But when the media begin to ease off and when they begin to independently distinguish themselves and treat the subject matter more comprehensively, they still are operating. They now revert to the real old-fashioned way that they used to operate with anyway, which is racist. In this period, you would find that there will be no Black or Latino experts about anything. They vanish. They put them to the side. They're not important. Yeah, you know, could have them file a report from the field. You know, they'll throw them out someplace in the outskirts to cover something, some menial aspect of the story. But the heavy lifting is going to be done by a chosen few, and they're almost always white. Strictly. And they particularly are adept at those kinds of stories that either originate in or have extraordinary impact on communities of color. And this is one of the stories. You'd find, for example, that while in the beginning, you would have a whole bunch of people participating. When it comes to now specializing, when it comes to basically portraying the news organization's voice, official editorial voice, that would be almost an all-white situation. No expertise is allowed by people of color, no matter what the subject is. So the media then reverts to its own racist way of operating. It is very rigid. It is very clear. These are our two or three stars. So now they begin to commodify information. Information now has not just monetary value, but it has symbolic value as well. And the symbolic value is the media returns to the old ways of white-dominated outlets talking to white communities primarily about subjects of people of color. That's how it works. And it's across the board. I mean, if you look a simple thing like the Food Network, do you know that it's hard to find a Mexican who's an expert on Mexican food? It's hard to find a good Southern black woman who knows who's an expert on Southern food. Expertise is not to be in the hands of people of color. Expertise about the situation is strictly controlled within media organizations, and they revert back to the old days of the 1960s where expertise is racialized. So when we see a situation of a perceived national crisis, the imagery is capitalized on by media organizations that had miserable, theretofore had miserable records of full diversity in their staffs. At the beginning, it's all hands on deck. We have to have people all over the place. Everybody just get ready to be assigned for whatever purpose we deem necessary. And as it begins to filter down and begins to get more and more specialized, it gets whiter and whiter and whiter. And I'm pointing this out because I don't want you to be alarmed. This is how it happens. And this is how they plan it. The information at this point becomes commodified. It's specifically identified with a person. It's not that the information in and of itself has value. Say, for example, in the days of Walter Cronkite, you would say, well, the information is the star. In this particular point, at this particular point I'm talking about, it's not the information that is the star. It's the star who presents the information is the star. Reinforcing, they go back to reinforcing the old social coders. We have people defining life in a way that even they don't know. For example, in this situation with involving Muslims, let's say, or that will be involving Muslims, and the discussion is largely about, they now invented this new word I told you that set me off, radicalized people. This is going to be a very sensitive topic. So for legitimacy's sake, they will have somebody ride shotgun, you know, just to take the edge off. But when it comes to the point of being extremely expert at anything, it would be a one-person show. And that's the way it's organized. Now, what does that mean? It means that you have to be defensive about how we regard information, because we think it's about the information. And I keep saying to you, pay attention to the symbology, pay attention to the environment in which things are occurring, and of course, pay attention to the message. In this space that we're in now, there is a collusion of effort. All sides need to work cooperatively with each other in order to get this task done, the task of building national identity and national fervor, even if it is artificial. But if they do a good enough job, and you saw how well it translated at the ball game, you know, we had a black ball player, a Spanish-speaking black football player saying, you know, this is our Boston, and people went nuts. And we have people talking about all the things that they started thinking about, the humanity of things, how we're all in this together, how we're all hurting, and so forth. And so an artificial environment is created. It doesn't exist really in our society, but for this purpose, they will see to it that it does exist, even for the short time, and then they go back to their old ways. So I would say that we are in phase two. The media will be backing off more and more from official authorities. And they will begin now to build on the matter of translating their coverage into money, making it commodified, making it monetized is a new word, to monetize information. And it will work well for the news organization, and it will work well for the individuals, the very few individuals chosen by these news outlets to represent, I hate to use the marketing term, but it's absolutely appropriate here, to represent the brand. To represent the brand. So, I hope that makes sense to you. If I'm making any sense, if I'm not making any sense, you let me know. But this is where we are. So watch carefully how we have transitioned into this other way of thinking and operating, and then it will go through the third phase, which is a return to the normal way of operating. What is especially important to understand here is, and don't underestimate it, this is a period, and it's within this context that people actually rewrite history. History actually is being rewritten. It is looking like news reports. It is looking like coverage. But it is history being written, and in some cases, rewritten. And as we know, history very seldom is written from the point of view of the oppressed. We don't have a real independent media institution as such. We're not quite there. But it must exist, which is why PRN is a very necessary outlet. And it has to be supported in order for it to grow. There's no counter-offensive in the way of information that operates as efficiently as mainstream organizations. And that is the work that I wanted to suggest that we begin to do, which is to support alternative media outlets. They may be small, they may even be, you know, just marginal, but that's okay. If they're doing good work, they need to be supported. So I'll take a little break here, and we come back to your thoughts and your questions at 888-874-4888 right after this. Thank you. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about the function of media in perceived national crisis. All right, 888-874-4888 is the number to call, and let's hear what you have to say. What are you noticing about media coverage? And let's be really specific about that. In terms of what I, you know, just laid out, does it make sense to you? Hello, Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Eutrice.
Thank you. You too.
Well, Eutrice, you have laid it out. And I must commend you, your treatise that you've just put out, because what you have stated is the fact. What we are seeing is that it's a state-run media, regardless of whatever names or tags they put on themselves, calling themselves independent, progressives, or whatever. It's all state-run and controlled apparatus. And what you have said is most people who have not read that book, 1984, by George Orwell, they might need to go back and do a reread of that book, because it will bring everything into focus as to what you are stating and what we are seeing happening before our very eyes. And that book was written almost 60 years ago. It's as if though he had a foresight as to what he was seeing was going to happen to us in the conditions that we are currently in.
Actually, it was happening to him in his era, too.
Exactly
the same thing. Yes, indeed.
Exactly, because all he did is he just flipped the year from 48 to 84 to push it out to see what it would be like now. But as you stated, with what the media, this controlled apparatus, which is controlled by the intelligence, the military, branch of the government, who is feeding people information, because as you said, it doesn't matter what channel you flipped on, you're going to hear the same thing, and the key buzzwords, extremism, jihadist, Muslim extremism, jihadist, these are words that they are pushing out here. Most people don't know what the meaning is. You never ask these people to define for us what is an extreme Islamist, or what's an extreme jihadist.
I would still like the explanation. What is an ethnic Chechen? I have no idea what that is.
That's the same. It's the same thing as saying an ethnic American, because what exactly?
I was under the impression that no matter what you are, you have some kind of ethnicity. I didn't know that Chechens were special. That only they have an ethnicity. It was very interesting. They insist on using these terms, but yes, your observations are right on point. I want to ask, where do you see right now? As you observe the coverage, are you seeing a specific shift occurring?
Yes, I'm seeing, as you were saying, this sense of nationalism that is being pushed up here, and you're hearing I'm seeing a lot of black people are getting in on this, because I switch between different channels, radio channels as well, and I'm hearing black people are trying to become a part of this nationalist identity of identifying that we are Americans, that we need to protect our borders, and these people are extremists, and we need to, you know, enact legislation and all of these other things that they are saying. And I'm saying to myself, I said, you know, we really and truly need to step back and realize that we are also in this cross here that these people are weaving, this web that they are weaving. What makes you think that now you are part of this clique, this club? Because as you said, Eutrice, it's mostly white males who are these so-called subject matter experts, and they were bringing, as you said, maybe a so-called an imam or whatever from one of these communities to explain certain things about Islam. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of going into details and saying what they have to do, it's always white males. It's nobody from these communities who know more about Islam, the Muslim sensibilities, and what's going on with them to really give you a detailed explanation.
Well, thank you, Sarah. You got us started today. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Orville, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
First of all, I wanted to ask you, with this line of thought, are you keeping it just on the marathon coverage, the Boston Marathon, or are you opening it up?
Well, we're using the marathon coverage as a case in point, because it's so wonderfully illustrates a number of points about media and the role of media generally in our society, but particularly in situations where we can say, well, there's a national crisis. How do the media organizations behave in a national crisis? So that, you know, we seldom take a look at that, you know? Mm-hmm. But you had something else tangential that you wanted to talk about?
Well, in terms of a national crisis, sometimes health can be deemed a national crisis, disease or something like that. And I see that played out over the last 30 years. Well, for instance, look at HIV and AIDS. And there are so many different world-class scientists, even the person who discovered and got a Nobel Prize for the discovery of HIV, he goes counter. And there's Peter Duisberg, who is another winner of a Nobel Prize for virology. In fact, specifically, what is that type of virus? I forgot the type of virus that HIV is described as, but retrovirus. And he's the person one, he's the father of that. And he, if anyone goes against that particular thought that of this national crisis and the spokespeople or the national, I'm reaching for words, but the original think or thought, they are immediately paid no attention to, and sometimes their funding are taken away, and they're looked upon as outcasts and pariahs, and they're deemed quacks. But just a few months ago, they were deemed, you know, Nobel Prize worthy, and they were being given all types of aid. So I just wanted to put that there and seeing how do we look at this to see that it transcends this kind of immediate violence. It transcends throughout the society, you know, that we occupy.
Well, the point I'm making here is if media organizations in a so-called crisis can actually do or achieve the goals of influencing opinions and influencing, therefore, decisions and actions, why is it that they can't function that way, you know, to the betterment of things? Why can't they, in as much as they can forge unity, why do they not function that way as a matter of course? In as much as they can influence public opinion, because it's demonstrated in a matter of urgency and national crisis, why do they choose not to do so as a matter of course? That's really the question that I'm raising here. And we see that they have the capacity to do it because they're doing it. Mm-hmm. It's just no desire to do it. There's no compelling reason because, in fact, very often the media and the machine, the state machine, the state apparatus, are just, you know, reflections of each other in terms of their class thoughts and their social class and their educations and their mindsets pretty much are very much parallel with each other.
So there's a question that you asked there. You said, why do they operate like this? And is there a larger agenda, people who control what goes on the planet, because they say it's getting smaller and smaller, and you can see it with media ownership, you can see that with health and multinational corporations.
And oh, sure.
I think people talked about Monsanto now is actually bigger than governments.
Well, it's not a new story. Mm-hmm. I mean, there have been versions of this kind of monopolistic power going all the way back, I imagine, to, you know, from the beginning of time. People, I'm sure, who felt that they had or they were occupying a very nice, fruitful area of land, hoarded their stuff. You know, it goes all the way back. But we're taking a look at the functioning of media today in the current situation.
So what I'm asking you is in terms of looking at it, as you asked, why are they operating this way? And I'm saying that it's gotten to a point on this planet, like you're saying, that it used to be like a farm. Can the powers, quote unquote, the power elite, also look at the planet now as a farm and move things around and create crisis.
Well, they've never stopped. This is my point. They've never stopped. The point is, what has changed was that at one point they used to, the money stayed put, or the assets stayed put, and the people were moved around. Now they want the people to stay put because the money is being moved around. That's the only change, you know. Thanks, Orville, for calling in. Thank you. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Are you an astute observer of how the media organizations are operating? Michael, I'm sure you are an astute observer. Michael of New Jersey.
Well, I observe something. I don't know how astute it is, but I always have fun talking with you anyway.
Thank you.
The thing is that I've noticed is, I agree with your what you said at the beginning, that these journalists start to brand themselves and they start to make it more about them. And you know what? I noticed something that's very different than, you know, Walter Cronkite days, when the anchor stayed in the studio. He didn't budge. You know, he was there reading his script. Now I find that the anchors are becoming the correspondents. They go out into the field and they get on the scene.
Well, actually, that is just for show. It is just to give a sense that they are, quote, on the job, unquote. But the fact is, as they stand there, there's a whole staff that is doing exactly what a staff did in the old days of Walter Cronkite, which is assembling the information, assembling the flow of information, and so forth.
No, but it goes along with what you say. I agree with that, where it used to be the information itself was the star. But now it's becoming these folks that, like Ed Schultz, goes out to Detroit or Wisconsin, and he broadcasts from there. The whole crew is there, of course. You know, it's like a studio, but it's been placed. And Anderson Cooper is right in the hospital room, sitting on the bed, talking to a young lady who lost her bottom of her leg. And to get all that, you know, all that perspective, like, you know, here I am. I was in the studio, but here I am at the next, you know, sitting next to the hospital, in the hospital, sitting next to this woman, interviewing her from bed. So I don't think this went on in the past. They'd have correspondents that went out to the scene and interviewed people on the scene. But now the anchors, because they're in this particular way of branding themselves, that want to show them, you know, as doing all the jobs. You know, they're the mm-hmm. correspondent. They're collecting the facts. They're reporting the facts. They're investigating the facts. But really, we're not getting at the perspective. You know, we're really not getting. We're getting sensationalism, advertisement of their brand, but we're not getting a perspective as like a documentary. I was the other night watching I probably should have seen it a long time ago, but it was for the first time I watched the documentary about the Central Park Jarga and those five those five kids that were convicted.
Yes.
And there's Mayor Koch screaming, they're guilty, you know, they'll tell you this, and there's the mayor, Mario Cuomo, saying, you know, making a comment.
Governor.
The governor, I'm sorry. And you got such perspective. I mean, I was like enthralled watching this, and, you know, to see that even today, those kids, you know, who were totally innocent, their lives completely messed up, and they apparently their case is still not settled.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that, as you said, the black press was on that story and had been saying that these young men were not guilty from the time it happened. And just dismissed.
They were marginalized completely.
Sure.
As being like out there on the fringe, you know. And they were providing the only perspective, which backs up your point about alternative media, and how important it is to gain perspective from that, because from this, from the studios of New York, we're not gaining any perspective.
None at all.
As it advances, years later, Rachel Maddow will come out with this documentary kind of production about, Cheney and Rumsfeld making decisions about Iraq, how we got into that war and everything. It's years after the fact that they come out with something that looks like a documentary, but nothing like what I saw about those kids and the Central Park jogger. I mean, what great perspective that a documentary can give you, with hindsight, with background. We should be getting educated about where these kids came from, what the issues were there. We get no education.
Well, the thing is, that's a wonderful example of indictment of major media. It's not that the information wasn't available. They just insisted that they didn't need to pay any attention to it, and they dismissed it. Why? Because even before the facts of this case were known, the mayor declared them guilty. The New York Post, the Daily News,
that's
the New York Times.
Mayor Koch came out there and said they're guilty as sin. Don't even pay attention to what they're telling you. They're guilty.
And declared it as fact. And the media complied. Nobody wanted to cover this case fairly. The black newspapers and black media in New York City, they took on this case and said exactly what it was. Same situation with Tawana Brawley. I'm still the only reporter who has really covered this case from fact.
It's a travesty. It's a complete travesty.
Thank you, Michael, for
You're
calling.
Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
We have time for at least one more call, 888-874-4888. This is important because I'm trying to suggest that you don't just blindly consume information. You have to put your defenses up, and you have to start questioning what you read and see and what you read and hear and see in the way of information. Especially at a time like this, there are very interesting and secretive things at work to create an unreality, and they know it. It's let's go with this, because out of this they can get individual fame and heightened profile and more money for advertising, and it could fill. They fulfill their mission and their job with the state. Here, we are putting out the story the way you want it. But the consumer suffers because we continue to get, in terms of, quote, information, things that are probably just not right. We need to be questioning these things. And this is why we do this, so that you question everything you read. Is it making sense? Or if it's not making sense, what is it about the information you're receiving that causes you to have a certain uneasiness about it? Well, I don't know. I think we might as well wrap it up here, because we do have some just a little bit more time to go. I want to thank you. I'm getting a lot of great feedback. I want to encourage you to visit the Facebook page, Lead Stories, L-E-I Stories with Utrice Lead, and to register your view there, or to write me at leadstories@gmail.com. I get a lot of emails there too, and I really do enjoy corresponding with the folks who are listening and want to pass it on. But let us really make a very strong effort to grow PRN.FM. This should be, a must for people wanting to get an alternative view. This station should be it. So let's grow PRN.FM, and let's grow my little neck of the woods. I should say our little neck of the woods on Lead Stories. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to encourage you to come back again here tomorrow at the same time, and we'll talk again. Bye-bye.